tire. The shifting of the sands, not even time to fight it. Here comes the longest night, starless and Bible black. Here comes the longest night. Somewhere in the corner of my eye, I keep seeing shadows passing by. I know the past is not a place to hide. I'm just trying to keep it off my mind. There's sadness in the air this windy morning. I should be on my way. The summertime is over.
That was the title track from Abstract Crime Waves, The Longest Night. Now I'd like to provide an update on the SFU Red Leafs Lacrosse, which play in the Division 1 of the Pacific Northwest Collegiate Lacrosse League at this time. On February 22nd, before its game against the Utah Utes, the SFU Red Leafs Lacrosse thanked its Platinum Spartans. The SFU Red Leafs Lacrosse thanked its platinum sponsors, the Vancouver Warriors, Headlands Environmental Resources, West Shore Terminals, New Line Holes and Settings, and its diamond sponsor, One Performance Institute. As for the game on February 22nd, the Red Leafs fell to the Utah Utes 15-9. SFU were led by Riley Learn with 2 goals, 1 assist, and Josh Kupo with 1 goal, 2 assists for 3 points each. Nick Turin was named the One Performance Institute Player of the Game with 3 ground balls and gritty plays. Meanwhile, Utah were led by Trevor English with 1 goal, 5 assists for 6 points, Aiden Wallace with 4 goals, 1 assist, Nicholas Vermeulen with 2 goals, 3 assists for 5 points each. Also, Owen Edwards scored 3 goals, along with Joe Ellen with 1 goal and 2 assists for 3 points each.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIST.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.
Now I'd like to play my interview with Yuri Zalizniak on Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Just a minute, please. Just a minute. Let me play it out of my SoundCloud. Just a minute. There are some technical difficulties here. Now recording. Hello, it's Steve Chong. Today is February 26, 2025, and I'm interviewing. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Yuri Zalizniak. I'm associate. I have to start once again. My name is Yuri Zalizniak. I'm associate professor of New Media Department, Ivan Franko National University of Lviv, and currently here in Canada, I work with SERI as a research and a residence member of SERI Community Engaged Research Initiative at Simon Fraser University.
Today, we're talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which started all the way back in February 2014, soon after the then pro-Russia president Viktor Yanukovych fled Kyiv, and the war expanded to a full-scale invasion on February 24th, 2022, which is now over 3 years old. Yuri, thank you for the interview today.
Thank you for inviting.
First of all, tell me the roots of Russia's unprecedented attack on Ukraine, which goes all the way back to 2014.
I believe the problem in here is much more complicated and it goes far back beyond 2014. If we have like a couple of minutes, I will try to explain. Putin, in his interview to Tucker Carlson, was starting with some facts from the deep, deep past, like over almost 1,000 years ago. I will not go deep as he did, but still, I mean, contemporary Russia tends to portray itself as a third Rome empire. Like, first Rome, it was original Roman Empire. The second one, it was Byzantium, and Russia as the third Rome. It goes to the early 18th century, when actually partially representatives of Kyiv Church or Kyiv Orthodox Church went to St. Petersburg, and they were advising King Peter the Great, Peter the First, to start a new empire and to rename Moscow to something like more rooted in history, with a more profound history. So it has to be Rus. Now it has to be Russia. And since it's such a complicated historic matter, in 20th century, we have a lot of examples of Russian efforts to control Ukrainian territory, because without this territory, without these roots, they have no their original roots, at least as I understand it, in their, let's say, twisted mind. But I mean, we are also responsible for proper analysis of our opponent, of our foe. If we talk about the war itself, why I said that it started far before 2014, because during the last 33 years of Ukrainian actual independence, there were several attempts of Russian Federation at least to take some parts of Ukraine, especially in terms of like Crimea, the Crimean Peninsula. Before 2014, it was the year 2002 or 2003, I do not actually remember, there was an attempt when Putin was on the one hand conducting the second war in Chechnya, trying to suppress people of Chechen Republic, and at the same time he was trying to change the design of the Kerch Strait. So they were building a new dam that was actually changing the Kerch Strait in Crimea, and part of Ukrainian territory will be like covered with the waters of Azov and Black Sea. At that time, former president, he was Leonid Kuchma. He threatened Putin that he will fight back, that he will make some kind of assault on Taman Peninsula of Russian Federation, and Putin has to step back. And he did. He actually did. So for years and years, it was like an idea sex for Putin and for Russian almighty rulers to like revoke the Russian or the Soviet empire. And as far as I remember, in year 2007 on the Munich Security Conference, Putin said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the biggest tragedy or the catastrophe of the 20th century. So once you understand this statement, you can maybe understand why that war started. But I would like just to point one thing, that the medal for reuniting Crimea with Russia was dated on February 20th. So one or 2 days before the president that you mentioned, pro-Russian President Yanukovych, fled to Russia. So officially, Russia was trying to capture and recaptured Crimea from the ruler, the former ruler, who was Yanukovych at this time. So there are certain evidence that they were in a hurry because they were dealing with what is called Second Maidan or Revolution of Dignity, because the First Maidan in Ukraine, not only in Kyiv, but in Ukraine itself, was in 2004. It was so-called Orange Revolution, and that was also a matter of big concern for Russian Federation. That's why in 2008 they invaded Georgia, and there was a very soft response from the world, I mean from the civilized world, especially from the United States, but they were still supporting it. But that was George Bush administration. But in 2014, there was no even such kind of response from the rest of the civilized world. But nevertheless, as I'm saying, we are not just victimizing Ukraine. I'm not just trying to victimize Ukraine. Everybody has to be responsible for being a proper actor, understanding your foe, your opponent, and his capabilities, and be ready.
However, there have been a lot of pro-Russia rhetoric online, which I will go through one by one. First of all, the former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland led a coup d'etat, otherwise known as Euromaidan. That's an allegation. Explain. Respond.
I believe that's a part of Russian propagandistic narrative that goes far in history, trying just to justify their intervention, their invasion, saying, okay, our enemy is the United States, and take a look at the history, how they created Kosovo precedent, for instance, like tearing apart of Serbia. So what's the difference? Now we are doing pretty much the same with Crimea or eastern part of Ukraine, using not only just soft power, but creating some independent states, so-called Donetsk People Republic or Luhansk People Republic. And they were pointing out on some American officials who were visiting Ukraine, especially Victoria Nuland. So it's like already a mobiton for propaganda, but I mean, it's still online. It's still actual in terms of Russian justification of the invasion.
Another justification from Russia is Ukraine's alleged genocide of Russian speakers in the East.
I believe the answer will be very short. At least 50% of people are fighting currently in Ukrainian army with Russian aggressors are Russian speaking. So how about that?
Good to know. One more, rhetoric. NATO expanding its borders with Ukraine trying to join NATO forced Russia to act, and therefore Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine is a NATO proxy war.
You know, it's a poor argument that we are going just to justify Russian invasion in that way, that Russia is just trying to defend itself. So it's like a victimization of an actual aggressor. So we are acting like that because we are very afraid of independent state, okay, neighboring independent state, deciding to join NATO because this state is afraid of Russia due to the very complicated and bloody history. So we are justifying, I mean, Russia is justifying its invasion in the in this case, like, okay, we are just protecting ourselves from something that would probably happen in some kind of perspective because we are afraid. So if it's in your twisted mind, it's a that poor justification for any kind of tools or instruments you are using to reach your goal. Because sometimes even a nice, like good goal or serving common good goal, when it is when you use instruments or methods that are far from like being rational, far from being like human oriented, then the goal is very poor because the methods are bloody and just to some extent even dangerous for the whole humanity.
What would you like to say to some people promoting the Kremlin rhetoric? Jeff Sachs, a Columbia University professor, Joe Rogan, who rebuked the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on being allowed to strike deep into Russia, pushing the world to World War III, and Dmitry Laskaris, a lawyer and a journalist in Canada, who agrees with the U.S. President Donald Trump, who alleged the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is a dictator, suggested Ukraine started a war against Russia. This is from Trump. And Ukraine owes U.S. $350 billion.
I would generalize my answer as, you know, in terms of freedom of speech, anyone can say anything he or she wants. But there is, like, such a principle of being responsible for what you're saying. And before saying something, at least I'm just expressing my point of view on all of these allegations, in terms of cognitive warfare, you have to ask yourself before saying something, how do I know this as a basis or a ground for any things I write, any things I say, any things I promote? So am I sure that this information is 100% solid, fair, and the resource or the source of the information is not trying to use me as a useful idiot or whatever? Some people tend to name these people that they are just useful idiots for Russian propaganda. But no, I assume that they are not idiots at all. Once they are able to ask themselves, what is the source of my information? What are the facts, the real facts, not alternative truth? In terms of cognitive warfare, I don't want to be a victim of that warfare. That's why I question everything. That's why I use a doubt as a method of learning things from this life. And especially in terms of international relations, and you have to be very careful with labeling other people. And it doesn't matter whether it's a president or just a common person, your neighbor or whoever it is.
Three more questions. What was your reaction to the U.S. president, Donald Trump, calling the Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, which led to officials in both countries holding negotiations in Saudi Arabia without Ukraine?
It's very hard to say what's in people's minds. Maybe like some analysts are trying to explain President Trump's attitude with his way of dealing with negotiations and like a businessman in this case. But to my mind, you see, in this case, Russia maybe looks like a winner, because finally there's no Europe, there's no Ukraine at the table, only equal opponent, and they see themselves as something big and very respectful, since they are back to the table. So since they are invited back to the table after 3 years of aggressive and very bloody war that took lives of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and maybe millions of people. So in this case, from Ukrainian perspective, it looks at least not very nice. But, you know, I'm just trying to be here not very emotional, because especially in terms of social media and modern communication strategies, once you're ready to emotionally react to some statements, news articles, or even titles online, you have to calm down and ask yourself, what is the rational part of it, and am I ready to react in this emotional way, accepting the possible consequences of this acting?
Explain the latest mineral deal between U.S. and Ukraine, which allegedly has no security guarantees for Ukraine.
You know, only today I saw that there is a preliminary text of the deal, and I had no time to examine it well. And I'm not an expert in raw materials, and especially some rare metals. But it looks as if American president had to demonstrate to his own nation his effectiveness in terms of protecting its interest, I mean the U.S. interest, as he understands it, and as his voters, as people who backs him up, understand this. So sometimes messages targeted on internal audience are different in terms of the messages targeted on external audience. The same in Ukraine. I believe Ukrainian president has to show his strength, especially because he is now considered as one of the strongest leaders in the whole world, since he didn't flee, he stayed in Kyiv. I mean, that's that image that is like quite popular right now still in Ukraine. On the other hand, I believe the administration in Kyiv understands that without American support, without the support of the rest of the world, including united or partially united Europe right now, Ukraine will not be able to protect itself and to oppose the aggressor and to fight back in a proper way. We can discuss definitely the problem that maybe the reaction of the civilized world was very slow and the support was not enough. But as I said earlier, I mean, we have also to be responsible for the situation we are in right now, because that's the result of our decisions, of our deeds, or some things that we didn't do in a proper moment. Because, you know, sometimes even a proper thing done in a wrong moment is not a proper thing anymore. So in this case, I can only assume that the deal will be different from that image as it was portrayed like 2 weeks ago or 1 week ago, when it was like some with some numbers. There are no more like 500 billion, as far as I remember, in that deal. But still, I didn't examine the text. If this text that appeared today is the final version that will be signed probably on Friday, on the last day of February.
Finally, what is your outlook on Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine after U.S. rejected the U.N.'s Ukrainian resolution condemning Russia's aggression?
Can you please repeat, because maybe I didn't understand the question.
Finally, how do you predict what will happen to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine? How will it end? After U.S. rejected U.N.'s Ukrainian resolution that condemned Russia's aggression.
Got it. I'm definitely not a prophet, and it's very hard to say what's going to happen next, but I believe there are still voices in Ukraine that are trying to accept the new reality. I mean, of international relations. And they are trying to explain that, okay, that's the way the U.S. are trying to negotiate with Russia, excluding certain words from resolutions, saying nothing about aggressor or dictator in terms of actual Russian President Vladimir Putin. So the only thing, if that war happened, I mean, since it's the reality, it means that something was wrong with the world order long time before year 2002, 2022, 2023, 2024. So that's the consequence of maybe some mistakes, maybe some misleading decisions or wrong words being said long time ago. So definitely we are not dealing with a new era in the end of the history, as it was said when the Soviet Union collapsed. But I mean, the reality is very unpredictable. The future is very unpredictable. And I don't want just to predict something. But we have to remember that some analysts are saying that Russia is the only country with unpredictable past, because they are always rewriting books and manuscripts, trying just to justify their politics. It's great on the one hand that we are dealing with unpredictable future, because it's the responsibility that is on us to make that future better than the past, and especially that past that we still remember. I mean, the horrible Russian invasion and the war that Russia is still conducting against Ukraine and the whole civilized world. But I believe it's a problem of the whole civilized world that war happened.
Thank you for your detailed analysis this afternoon. This interview will be online likely tomorrow and will air on CJSF Friday afternoon.
Thank you, Steve, for inviting. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
That was my interview with Yuri Zalesniak, who is the SFU series researcher in residence. Today, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met the U.S. counterpart Donald Trump at the White House today, where it devolved into a shouting match along with the U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance, and no mineral deal was signed. I'd like to provide an update on the SFU Red Leaf softball, who are playing the St. Martin Saints at Beattie Field in the Burnaby main campus. St. Martin's is leading 6-2 in the bottom of 7th. Thank you for listening to episode 9 of the Steve Chong Show in 2025, part of Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 FM, the campus community radio station for Simon Fraser University. I'm your host, Steve Chong. Coming up at 4, it's Voice of the North.